Hi, and welcome back to this week's edition of Our Community. You know, last week we were joined by Brookings Core Response Executive Director Diana Cooper and by Brookings resident and alternate on the Curry County American Rescue Plan Stakeholders Committee, Hank Cunningham. And there was so much to discuss that we actually ran out of time. So we decided to pick up where we left off last week. Hi, Diana, and hi, Hank. Welcome back.
Hello, Candace.
Thank you.
It's good to hear your voices again. So we talked about the city's ongoing conflict with the services at St. Timothy's and how those services, which include COVID testing and vaccinations and serving meals to the hungry, are actually really important services for the community. And in the midst of a pandemic, it's an interesting time to decide that these services violate zoning regulations, especially considering that St. Tim's has been offering these meals for at least a decade and housed a low-cost health clinic on site for years. The city manager received an email from the Oregon Health Authority basically saying that they were very troubled by the city's attitude. Our news department recently did a story on this, getting comments from both OHA and city manager Janelle Howard. That report and supporting documentation can be found on our website at kciw.org under news. What we didn't get to last week was the other item on the City Council workshop on August 30th, accessory dwelling unit or ADU housing. Anyone who's paying attention knows that we have an affordable housing crisis. It's a national problem, but we're experiencing it here locally, both countywide and in the city of Brookings. The repercussions of the crisis are very real, and the latest real estate boom here is just exacerbating the problem. What is affordable housing? Either one of you can just jump right in and what's that definition?
I will do my best to define affordable housing as well as affordable workforce housing, which is close, but not exactly the same thing. So I've been on a couple of housing committees in Curry County over the past few years. My interest in the field goes back to my wife and I owned a condo, which we used as a second home. It was in a complex with 20-some units, and it also included some short-term vacation rentals. And we didn't live in ours full-time to begin with, but we never rented it out, short-term or otherwise. There were some other units in the complex that were just regular month-to-month rentals, and never a problem with them. Where there was a problem for those of us who either lived there full-time or as a second home was the traffic going through these short-term vacation rentals. There were noise, there were code violations, police calls, trash, not honoring the rules like on recycling and so forth. And it was just a constant problem in the opinion of ourselves and other owners. So it's still there. The complex is still there. I'm assuming they still have short-term vacation rentals, which require a conditional use permit from the city of Brookings and a $2,000 fee. However, I don't think other than that, there's much of any regulation from the city with regard to these units. And eventually we sold our condo. It's a nice complex. You know, we sold it, made a few bucks on it and no problem there. But it just that what the main problem in my mind, in addition for other, the negative impact on other owners and residents, is the fact that this is taking away from workforce housing, that nurses or teachers or any number of different folks could rent. And that's the way some of the units, maybe half of them were used in that way. The owners of the units just rented them out on a month-to-month basis to various workers in the community. And that, I think, is a very positive thing. But what happens when those owners, if they switched over, if they went and got a conditional use permit, which the Planning Commission approves routinely, despite testimony, in our case, we testified several times at public hearings of the Planning Commission against them. And they always just say, well, it's property owner rights, and we can't tell a property owner what they can or can't do. So it never got to be a majority of the units were short-term vacation rentals. If it had, it would have been impossible for prospective buyers of condos there to get financing from a bank, because a bank doesn't want to see that either. They don't want to see a place with over 50% short-term rentals, because they know the problems involved,
right,
and they're loaning their money and do not want their money put at risk. So that's my view on short-term vacation rentals.
So affordable housing then is what, something that would be, go ahead.
Yeah. Let me give you a couple definitions. So over the past few years, I was on a couple different housing committees for the county. I'm not on one currently, but I was on the Curry Housing Task Force, and that task force worked very hard for 2 or 3 years on based upon a study that was done, a consultant study that was done on the housing marketplace and in Curry County. And the definitions that came out of that study, the working definition for housing cost and income requirements in order to be able to afford certain levels of housing, they divided it into three categories. Marketplace housing, which was identified as 120% of area median income. Area median income, as defined by HUD in 2019, was $53,400 per household. Workforce housing was defined as 60% to 120% of area median income. That would be under that definition of the HUD income levels, between $32,000 to $64,000 a year. Here, you know, we're talking about maybe some of these essential workers that support our leisure tourism-based economy. $32,000, yeah, I think they most of them would be in that category. And then on the lower end, affordable or supportive housing at less than 60% of area median income, or less than $32,000 a year. That's for the whole household, you know, family of four, whatever. So that the household income. So that was the definition that we adopted with that particular committee, the Curry Housing Task Force. Subsequently, I was appointed to the Curry County Housing Committee as the veterans representative. And I actually made a report. I was asked to make a report, and I made a report at the May 2021, just this year, committee. This was before I left the committee. And it was entitled, "What is Workforce Housing?" So, thinking to myself when I made the presentation, well, I can't just say that that's just totally low income. In other words, lower than $32,000 a year. So what I did was create a definition that of, first I explained the Housing Task Force definition, 60 to 120% AMI. And then I recommended, and it was adopted by the committee at that time, that we focus on that range, 60 to 120%, and in particular, focus on 60 to 80% AMI, not the way low end. I mean, there's other groups that are working on extremely low-income housing. Very low-income housing is what HUD defines it as. But no, I thought, okay, let's be reasonable. These are the people, they have jobs. They're working in mainly in service industry. It's supporting our economy. It's very important. And that was adopted by that committee at the time. And it was, I also, as part of that report, talked about Oregon House Bill 2003, which requires now all communities over 2,000 population to create a regional housing needs analysis. This is nothing new in HUD vernacular. RENAs have been around for years. And that, as part of that, there's a responsibility to create affordable housing. You know, what I call workforce housing.
So can I ask you something? If that is a requirement, is the creation of affordable housing also a requirement, or is it just necessary to have a study done?
Okay, good question. Because back in 2018...
Right, Diana?
Yeah, I was just thinking.
That's a very good question.
A whole other question, Candace.
Yeah. Because we've got the study, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Let me quote from a City of Brookings staff report, May 7th, 2018, which was regarding housing issues. And there's a lot of really good information in the report. But among other things, it says, this is a quote, "The city has a legal requirement to provide access to affordable housing. The state requires local governments to provide for needed housing, quote unquote, and prohibits local governments from barring government-assisted housing." And then it references Senate Bill 1051, became effective in 2018, which, again, I'm quoting, mandates cities with populations more than, I said 2,000, that's 2,500 population, are required to allow at least one accessory dwelling unit for each detached single-family dwelling within areas zoned for single-family dwelling within an urban growth area. And then I've mentioned before, Brookings Municipal Code, Chapter 17.1.80, put that into law. And that's what the city, Brookings Municipal Code, calls the Workforce Housing Ordinance, quote unquote.
Yeah, I think I read this. I think I remember reading this recently.
So, and basically, isn't that just saying that single family dwellings can have ADUs on them? I mean,
well,
is that?
Let me quote once again. I may have said this in a previous show, but Brookings Municipal Code, Chapter 17.180, this is right out of staff report, workforce housing, established by ordinance such and such, in staff's opinion, Brookings City staff, in staff's opinion, satisfies this requirement.
Hmm.
Well, that's nice. Is
wow.
It?
How does that, it does not satisfy, I mean,
well,
I'm not.
In staff's opinion, it does.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I read, so, was that from the Brookings Housing Study report? What are you reading that off of?
I'm reading this from the staff report to a 2018 City of Brookings Council workshop. And that's
okay,
right,
yeah,
in the staff report.
I think,
and
that's what I read too.
Yeah, I think it is too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it talks about any other things, you know, tiny homes and so forth. But
it doesn't actually do anything, right?
No, I mean, it doesn't do anything. And it belies the question, how many ADUs have actually been built in Brookings?
Well,
I don't know. I haven't heard of any.
That's a very passive way to address the housing crisis.
Yes.
It's very
passive. Allow ADUs, right? That's like...
Because you're going off of goodwill and you're going off of resourcing. And a lot of the folks that are in need of that housing don't have the resources. And the ones that do typically want the short-term rentals. And so that's not what we're seeing. We're not seeing a resolution from that.
No, not at all.
So you've got short-term rentals, or sometimes called VRBOs, which is vacation rental.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Vacation rental.
Vacation rental by owner. It's the same thing. That's a short-term vacation rental. So if you see that acronym, that's all they're talking about.
Great.
You know, I feel that those units could be viable workforce housing rental units. In some cases, they were in the complex that we previously owned and lived in.
We've actually seen it happen, haven't we, Diana? Because, you know, I'm thinking the houses that have gone and gotten the conditional use permit were actually long-term rentals before they were changed into short-term rentals, weren't they?
I think a few of them were actually just the owner occupied and then it was sold and switched right away. I think there's actually one behind my house that was just sold recently. And I noticed another interesting thing that I noticed just about every day there's an RV parked on the side of the road next to this house. And they're nice RVs, you know, they're very nice. Mm-hmm. But there's a different one every couple days, sometimes every week. Mm-hmm. And I can guarantee you if there was a, you know, well, I'm not going to say the word I was going to say. If there was a not so nice looking RV parked on the side of the road for any length of time in any neighborhood, that would be tagged and towed.
Yep.
So
parking, that's a good point. Parking is another issue for these complexes.
And it's also discriminatory parking. Like, because what Diana is saying is if it's a nice RV and it's clearly somebody who's got, you know, a lot of money invested in that RV, a couple million dollars or however much they cost, the reaction to them, to that RV and to the people living in the RV by, you know, the law enforcement is completely different than if that RV were really kind of on the low end and was clearly owned by somebody who didn't have a lot of money to put together. I mean, it's a problem.
I mean, we know that because those are the people we work with. And I can't tell you how many calls I get, even if they move it daily, I think the issue is, you know, there's nobody living in the one that's behind my house. But there's nobody that owns the property in front of it. They're very lucky because nobody owns that property that they keep parking in front of. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is it's there. Every week there's one there. Almost every day there's one there. So yeah, it's an interesting, just something I noticed.
So the problem that we have is it's not that we don't have enough housing for people on the high end. You know, like if they're looking at a $750,000 home or $1 million home, we've got those. It's not like there's a shortage of those homes.
Yeah, I think there's one actually just up here on Fifth Street, and there's one right next to it that has a for sale sign as well. And I know those are some pretty spendy ones. I'm sure there's, you know, you can probably drive down any nice road and see one or two for sale out in Harbor even.
So the shortage that we're talking about and the shortage that it appears to me that at least our city council is not addressing is the shortage of affordable housing, even using the HUD definition, and certainly affordable workforce housing. It's like that's being completely not taken into consideration.
It's worse than that. I have heard now from one elected official in public meetings. So I'm not talking out of school. And one appointed official on that housing committee that I left. The reason I left, the main reason, was kind of got into a bit of a debate with one of the members about targeting to lower. And I wasn't even, again, I wasn't even going for the lowest income levels. I was going for the lower end of median, you know?
Yep.
And so even though this had been adopted, and this is just an advisory committee, so it wasn't adopted by the County Board of Commissioners, although that's what I would have hoped would have happened. At this point in time, I don't think anything's happening. And the argument or the debate and these public comments I've heard from elected and appointed officials is that the emphasis should be on all housing, quote unquote, not just workforce housing. Well, okay, What do you get? There's not a problem on the high end.
Yeah, we don't have issues with all housing. That's reminiscent of like the Black Lives Matter when people said all lives matter. And we're saying, right. Yeah, but we're talking about the ones right now that are having a struggle.
Exactly.
It's very much analogous to that. Same difference. I don't think the people behind Black Lives Matter were asking you or telling you to discriminate against other groups or races. No, they were just saying, more like Black Lives Matter too, or also.
Exactly. You know, like, or maybe we want to pay attention right now. Yeah.
Be like if I had two of my kids in the pool and they both had the same life, you know, little floaties on and one was going down, I'd be like, well, you got the same thing, you know. Fair treatment. We want fair treatment all around.
You both have the same floaty. Bye bye.
Yeah.
Make
it work.
So this emphasis on all housing, quote unquote.
Yeah.
To me, I have a problem with that. And I had such a problem. And I heard other voices on the committee starting to reinforce that idea of all how well we can't discriminate. The conversation got all twisted around, and it was like, oh, you're discriminating and blah blah blah.
But if
and
you don't,
I decided I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this.
I don't blame you.
If you don't discriminate with the kind of assistance that you're wanting to provide as far as housing, if you don't discriminate, if you don't create some sort of direction. If you just leave it open to fair, you know, just anybody can build and we'll, you know, like the infrastructure talk, we'll put in this infrastructure for, just put in the infrastructure, the people will come and build it. Well, but they discriminate. So they're going to build the housing they want to build that's going to make them money. So you have to be intentional. You have to be intentional.
Exactly. Yes. And that's why I call that the laissez-faire approach or highest bidder approach. Well, the highest bidder is not going to be to build a subsidized apartment, multifamily apartment project in a lower income neighborhood in the county.
Nope.
It's just not.
But what happens? I mean, think about this for a minute. So what happens if we don't have affordable workforce housing here? What happens? I mean, I don't think this is like, you need a magic crystal ball to see this. But a couple of years down the road, what are we looking at?
Well, you know, I've characterized our economy, and I think other studies have, as a leisure, tourism-based economy. Not exclusively. You know, there's the mill and other places that provide more regular type of jobs and middle income wages. And that's all well and good. That adds to the diversity of the economy, which is essential. Okay, what happens if you take away these lower end housing opportunities? That's what I was getting at. I think I read that letter about, you know, where are the people who wait your tables going to live? I'm not going to talk about the other characterization I heard. That wasn't from me, but I essentially the author of that and myself were saying the same thing.
Yep.
You know, where are these people going to live if there aren't not even low income, although that would be nice, but affordable workforce housing.
I mean, think about it.
60% to 120% rate.
Right. I mean, think about it. If you are, you know, let's say that you're a young family of four, and both the mother and the father are working, talking just nuclear family stuff right here. But if assuming that both of them are working, they probably are not making a lot of money. That's probably not what they're doing. And they've probably got money going out for childcare and rent and, you know, food and all of those things. Where in Brookings can they live?
And guess what? If they can't find a place to live, what happens to the restaurants, the hotels, the motels, these other tourism, leisure-related businesses? They're not, it's all complicated now by the pandemic, but you know, let's assume that things were back the way they were, and they will be eventually. How are these businesses going to survive? They're already having a big problem finding workers.
And I don't think that we can just assume that, you know, the pandemic is going to, you know, go away, right? I mean, right now we are in a pandemic, and right now we are trying to deal with people who can't keep their businesses open because their workers keep getting sick, or who have to close periodically so that people can get well again.
And there's this other caveat too that, well, there's a couple that tend to get just sort of lost in this matrix whenever we start talking about housing, especially when we start zeroing in on workforce housing. One of those is Brookings has, Brookings has one of the highest populations of seniors. Seniors are not typically in our workforce right now, right. Even in Curry County. We have a lot of them, sure, but the majority, and the majority of the people who don't have housing are seniors, by the way, have a disability. But regardless, they're on a fixed income. Mm-hmm. And so every single time we start talking about housing, everybody really wants to go to workforce housing. And I completely push back on that. I think that we should absolutely not be talking about workforce housing, because when you say that, it's like people contributing to the economy. Our seniors did and do. People who have disabilities, they do contribute to our economy. And when we close these gaps, the return on investment is that our community's social determinants of health, in other words, all of the pieces that make up our community's health, start improving. You know, mm-hmm. childcare improves, the hospital system improves, just all of the industries improve. And so that's one thing that I get really frustrated about when we start talking about housing, because everybody, even those I think that are like-minded to myself, start shifting to just talking about workforce housing because it's easier. But that is not solve our problem. That doesn't even begin to touch the problem, because the majority of the people who need housing are on fixed incomes. And the flip side of that, and the reason why that is because the majority of people working who can't afford housing, I shouldn't say that because I don't know the numbers myself, but just knowing the community the way that I do and the people that I talk to, we have a large part of our workforce that's doubled up or tripled up. You know, sometimes we have 2 to 3 families. It could just be individuals. They could have kids. They could have grandparents living with them. We have these multiple households living in one house. It's not often on the books. Sometimes those are not. They're not on the lease, and which also contributes to, I mean, think about what that means to double up with someone. We're not talking about a roommate situation where you're renting a room, not even close. We're talking about sleeping on someone's couch. You have no key. You have no rights to that place. And you can actually contribute to them losing their housing because you're not on the lease. And there's many reasons why they're not put on the lease. It could be that they don't make enough income, or the landlord, you know, has certain screening mechanisms where they would screen out. But the reality is that we have a lot of people working right now who are doubled up and tripled up. And that number has risen since COVID, which, I mean, also, contributes to some of the COVID cases, because we have people coming and going in one household that you didn't have necessarily before or to this degree. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, maybe a group of people working in a motel, all staying in one house, or various different industries work, you know, staying in one house. So if one gets sick, that's 3 industries that are now affected, and or businesses. So, you know, there's a couple of different gaps in this conversation that never get brought up and addressed the way that they should. And it's very frustrating.
And I think that's an excellent point about the seniors in this town, because a lot of them don't have much money. I mean, fixed income, absolutely, but not even a good fixed income.
Yeah, I mean, talking $800 or $900. And how dare we leave them out of this conversation as though they don't exist and they don't matter?
Yep.
I agree with you, Diana. I agree with you 100%. That's where the area of greatest need is. Mm-hmm. What I was trying to do with this concept of affordable workforce housing, getting down to the 60 to 80% of AMI, was to get something that would have a little bit broader appeal to our policymakers and so on. Believe me, Diana, I worked for 25 plus years in the field. I know.
I'm not frustrated with you. I'm frustrated at the fact that we have to maneuver that conversation in a way that's appealing to the powers that be, because the powers that be are not the ones living in this scenario. And frankly, I'm sometimes frustrated that they're even part of the conversation because they don't contribute anything.
The problem to me is if you take workforce out of the definition, we've got people that don't even want workforce housing. I know.
Right.
I was trying to kind of ease into this.
I know. And, I'm not good at that, Hank. I'm not great at easing in.
Well, and I'm not very good at it either.
We give you kudos for that. We do.
And even that gets it hasn't been shot down yet, but it probably will be based on the conversations that are going on. The mayor of Brookings just wants all housing, quote unquote, wants workforce out of the definition. So, I mean, you take workforce out of the definition, you're what?
If you are a city council, I won't say the county because they're actually paid to sit there. So they're technically working. But the city council, if you're sitting on the city council and you are retired, you should be invested in low income housing for seniors. Because, it's not going to be them. The people who are on our council probably do not fit in any kind of low income category. And that's me guessing, obviously. But if you're someone who's older and you're retired and you're sitting on that city council, you should absolutely be advocating for housing that will contribute to, you know, the positive health of seniors and people with disabilities. Because
particularly given what the population is here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it would be one thing if it was just a small slice of our population, but it's not a small slice.
But I do agree with you, Hank, that it's more palatable for other people, but that's my sticking point, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't even care that it's palatable, to be honest, but that's probably why I won't be running any projects anytime soon.
What's ironic to me, there are at least three subsidized apartment complexes in Brookings, two of which I have actually visited. I haven't been inside the units, but Ocean Winds Apartments on Lucky Lane.
You got the Heron Azalea, Ridge.
Heron Ridge, which I pass by a couple times a week. I've delivered meals there, not meals. I've delivered food orders through OHA. And by the way, Oregon Health Authority. And by the way, St. Timothy's, in the absence of the county or anyone else running the local health authority, that OHA has enough confidence in St. Timothy's that they are contracting with them not only to do COVID testing and vaccinations, but also to do these ancillary, they call wraparound services, which includes things like what I do is I go to Fred Myhick, I get an order through this wraparound committee. Diana, you probably run it, so I know I'm preaching to the choir, but so I get an order.
I don't run that one, actually. So
I get an order. I go to Fred Meyer. I dial the general number. It's all anonymous. They don't know who the client is. And then I pick up a meal, give them the correct phone number. I deliver the meal, just a first name basis. I pull up to usually their apartments, and I pull up. I have the phone number and first name. I'll say, hi, this is Hank from St. Timothy's. I have a food delivery for you. And these are COVID positive people, but it's all no touch distance. I just say, can I drop that at your front door? I'm in the driveway right now. Just drop it at the front door. And let me tell you, this is saving lives. These people are so, because they're not supposed to go out. If they go out to Fred Meyer, then they're spreading it more.
That's right. So you were saying I see the need. Yeah. So you were saying that there are three places that you know of that are low income?
Well, that I know of. And
there,
I don't know.
There
when
are
they
a
were...
couple of others that are more senior living down on Moore Street, Pelican's Perch, I think, and I can't remember the other one right now. But those other three.
But let me tell you, the one on First Street, Heron Ridge, is one of the more attractive, nicely maintained properties on mm-hmm. that block. And you'll remember this is the same block where the petition came from.
Right.
And, you know, so here's a low income subsidized. It was whenever it was done originally, it was through USDA. And I think there's HUD money in it also. But these are low income apartment buildings. And there's three. And Diana, you mentioned there's a couple more for senior citizens. So this has been done before.
Yes, it has been done before. And there's nowhere near enough, right? I mean, when you look at our at the composition of our community, there's nowhere near enough. I mean, we see, like on a daily basis, we see people who are saying, you know, I can't find a place to live. I'm going to have to leave. Yeah. I'm going to have to leave the community. And these are people who, some of them were born here. Some of them go back a couple of generations. I mean, these are our community members, and they can't afford to live here anymore. I mean, you know, we're watching the boom, the current boom in real estate, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, even in 2018, that consultant report, Brookings Housing Needs Assessment, indicated a need for 452 additional subsidized rental units. And by that definition, they are talking about the low end, you mm-hmm. know, less than 32,000, but at the very least, less than 32,000.
And nothing has been done since then. Nothing.
I don't know when the last one of those was built.
The Ocean Winds was built just, so I was gone between 2012 and 2019. I was gone for that like 7 years. I was living in Jackson County. And in that time, that is when the Ocean Winds was built, which I think was like 5 years ago. I may be off by a year or two. But the Heron Ridge used to be the, I don't know how long you guys have both been here, but used to be the Darwin Apartments. And I think those were rebuilt maybe 10 years ago. And I could be off on that by a few years, but yeah. They were rebuilt sometime, you know, about that long ago. And I think they expanded and added additional units. So it's a very nice
complex. It's a beautiful complex.
And the Ocean Winds is very nice. I mean, those are some really nice places.
I've delivered groceries there also.
Yeah.
There has not been anything happen though since the report
came out.
No, not
since that. No.
Since 2018. So here we have a report that says specifically 452 new low cost
very low
units,
income, mm-hmm.
right? And nothing has been done. So where's the city planning? I'm sorry, but where is it?
Yeah.
Where is it?
There must be a way to become, I mean, we can't hinge everything on the county and the county's housing programs and things like that. Because, I mean, those are moving, but moving very slow. When we talk about the wheels of government, I think the bigger you go, sometimes the slower you go. Mm-hmm. And Brookings really does have the maneuverability to be able to put some of this in place and to be able to be proactive. You know, they could put together their own housing development committee or whatever the case may be to, and not just another committee to kind of sit around, but, you know, a committee to identify the land, to identify the builders, to identify the funding. I mean, specifically to work on housing in general. And that could be many different types of housing, but just having something, you know, attached to the city with that focus would be immeasurable. It would, in my opinion, would produce more housing than what we're seeing right now, which is just, like you said, the kind of passive, I forget what term you used.
Marketplace, whatever the market will bear.
Well, laissez-faire.
Laissez-faire.
highest bidder.
Yep, exactly.
And that's what, okay, you know, real estate agents are paid based on commission. Mm-hmm. So guess what?
Yeah.
The more the property sells for, the bigger the commission.
The better it is.
So yep, I don't see a lot of social consciousness amongst real estate agents.
You know
certainly
why
can't count on it.
You know why we don't see people so gung-ho and invested? Well, there's, I'm sure, the profitability, of course, but that's it itself. We don't see people so gung-ho over low-income housing because they don't see the return. It's there, mm-hmm. and it's mm-hmm. much bigger than any other kind of housing you could supply. I mean, just look at the, when I worked at AllCare, I used to work in care coordination as a community health worker, and I worked alongside a nurse and an intensive case manager. So it was a team of three, and we, you know, we worked with people on their social determinants of health, and that meant community-wide, whether it was projects that we were investing our time in or individual, we were, I did home visits. And so we did a lot of sort of just trying to improve the community health. And one of the pieces that I did was ED utilization management, which is emergency department use. And when people would go to the emergency department, I think it used to be more than 5 times in 6 months, but then I think they even scaled it down more, like 3 times in 3 months. Mm-hmm. They would get a call from me, and it would kind of, not directly like this, but it would kind of be like, so what's up? Why are you using the emergency room? How right. can we,
how can we help?
Oregon yeah. Health Authority is not, I mean, they're doing it sure to improve the lives, but it's, mm-hmm. it's all about the money. You know, they sure. don't want people going to the emergency room. So most of the time people were going to the emergency room for things that they could have gotten their needs met in housing. You know, one guy went to the emergency, he was calling, he was going to go to the emergency room because he left his cane there the last time he went. And so he was going to use 911, get back to the emergency room to get his cane. And wow. because he was homeless, he did not have a vehicle. He had no mm-hmm. other transportation there and no mm-hmm. social, he had no, social support. So think about just the act of having social support, of being socially accepted, to be able to call someone and say, I need a ride. Think of mm-hmm. how much money that one mm-hmm. thing would save. Mm-hmm. And so people do not see the return just directly related to housing, but they do see the cost of homelessness. They do see the cost of poverty. They see it all the time. They see it on their taxes.
Yeah, they just don't recognize it.
Yep. Right. And so yep. I think that the way to get some people on board, and it sounds like the people that we need on board are really just the people in positions of power. And the only way to really get them on board is to help them see the return on investment in not workforce, not even low income, but very low income housing. Because these are the people that are racking up the bills and cannot pay those bills. And it's not just the hospital. It's the jails and the recidivism in our criminal justice system. You know, that costs all of us money. And so we're sitting here handing over cash with one hand and putting up our hand with the other one and saying, no, we don't want any of that. We don't want that in our neighborhood. And we don't want that in our community or whatever the case may be, while we're forking over cash with the other hand. So one hand doesn't know what the other hand is actually doing.
Okay, let's say, I agree with you 110%, Diana, and I really do. I'm not kidding. And
no, I know.
But it's a matter of getting it done and addressing what you were saying earlier, Candace, about where's the city planning? Well, it starts at the top. Having been a city administration official, with a graduate degree in public administration, it's up. What city staffers do, even the highest management staffers, city manager, department directors, they do what they are told by the policymakers. Yes. So the elected officials set the policy. And then they say, you professional staff, you go out and get it done. That's what staff does. So don't expect any big initiatives coming out of staff. It's got to start at the top.
Starts at the bottom. That starts at the bottom because we're the stakeholders. So we're the ones that are supposed to come to them and say, this is what we demand of our council. This mm-hmm. is what we demand of our city. And, mm-hmm. demand is probably a strong word sometimes. But, we're the ones that are supposed to come forward. And this is another block that we have all the time. And especially during COVID. It is really hard to get people to gather and rally and come forward and support this. It's easier to do it in person, but we're in the middle of COVID, and all of the people that would traditionally do this are the ones that are being more cautious. And so we are at a disadvantage at the moment.
But I think you have to remember, Diana, that when Jake was mayor, I distinctly remember him saying several times that if a certain group of us walks into council, we are immediately made to feel unwelcome. We are immediately made to feel that we are not going to be listened to. So I agree. It starts with us. It has to start with us because we are the citizens that our government is supposed to be governing for. But if we what we have is a city government that automatically discriminates against certain people because we're too left-leaning or whatever, you know, whatever they use as criteria.
Right.
We have no voice, and that we keep pushing and pushing and pushing from outside the circle, but we're not allowed a seat at the table.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's essentially why we're here. And it's difficult to the other kind of group of people that maybe would be heard. I mean, to get more people in there, obviously, is a goal. And I think if the community members on both sides, all sides, I don't know how many sides there are at this point, but if the community members on all sides were to see that kind of this handoff that I was saying, where it's like, well, we don't want to spend money on that while they're shifting and spending money on it anyway in a different platform that's less adequate and doesn't actually solve the issue. If those people were able to see, but we're also, I mean, mostly talking about people who it's sort of the wheels of government are supposed to roll in a way that we're all able to have equitable access to things. But the people who need that access sometimes also don't step forward just because, you know, they're busy. They're working. Maybe they are very low income and they're struggling a lot. They don't have time to go to a city council meeting. So it's kind of almost like there are some of us who are just that we just have to be advocates for the whole. But you're right. A lot of those advocates don't get listened to, you know, don't get a chance to kind of have a seat at that table. And yeah.
And then even when the suggestion comes from someone, say on the more conservative side politically, like Jake Pieper, he gets shot down for merely suggesting, wouldn't it be a good idea to be doing something for the homeless here?
Absolutely.
That was the gist of what he was saying,
I think. Not only shut down, but actually forced to resign. I mean, it was just, couldn't have been plainer to anyone what that whole thing was.
And that was not a flaming liberal talking there, Jake.
Not quite.
I was being facetious.
Yes, but. I know. Yeah, and it was interesting because when Jake was elected the last time, I remember him saying that he was going to be sure that he spoke for the people who were not being represented by the rest of council. And look at where it
well, because that's why we weren't being represented.
That's right.
And so that's why we're not being represented again.
Yep.
So,
exactly.
I mean, exactly. I think at one point I even told him, you know, you better be careful because you're going to get taken for a liberal at some point.
Yep.
But, yeah.
Or you're going to get taken down, which is what happened.
Well, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even close to being a lifer here in Curry County or Brookings, but it does seem to me that things are evolving a bit just based upon the influx of new blood and people from other areas coming in to Curry County and Brookings that more enlightened policies and policy makers are going to come out of this evolution of our population.
Yeah, but how long is it going to take, Hank? Because seriously, I mean, I can't think of anybody who is more left-leaning that would have a chance at getting elected to. the city council. Mm-hmm. I mean, I look at the composition of the city council right now. It couldn't be more conservative. There is no way it could be more conservative.
Well, don't say that.
Oh, because there is a way it could be more conservative?
Well, I don't want to know.
No, I know. Yeah. I know.
Not that I don't like a conservative. I mean, I was raised here. It's a very conservative area.
Yes.
Most of my family and friends have. I have some conservative viewpoints. Very conservative.
So it's not even
about that. But we need that balance and we need that conversation, because if everybody's thinking the same thing, there's no conversation happening there.
That's right.
So there's no chance of having any variance from just what's put forward right off the bat. I've seen this in the meetings. I've seen something come forward, and I actually really appreciate sometimes Ed really just asks a lot of questions and it invites a lot more conversation than we would have normally. Mm-hmm. And so I do appreciate that very much from his corner. Mm-hmm. And even John sometimes throws in his sort of questions or comments to, you know, it doesn't invite a lot of conversation, but it's really helpful to hear them talk more, because it just gives us a better sense of where they're going with it and what they're talking about, I think.
I just really wish that they'd listen more than they talk.
Well, yeah, I mean.
You know, I mean, listen, and don't listen to just the people that you would normally talk to. You know, don't just listen to them, because of course you're going to hear the same thing that you've been hearing and that you expect to hear, and that just reinforces your position.
Right. Isn't there a term for that where you, like, if you're going to look something up, you look up with, you know, instead of like homelessness, you would look up like homelessness dangerous and kind of get skewed results. What's that? Yeah. Confirmation bias.
Yes. Confirmation bias.
And, you know, speaking of semantics, you know, Diana, like, if you were to come out and say, oh, I'm against workforce housing, well, I guarantee you that it's not going anywhere. Workforce housing semantically was a way of homogenizing income targeted housing, low income housing. Yep. You know, those were hot buttons that turned a lot of folks off. So I don't know. I'm sure there must be a better term than workforce housing. It looks like it's going down in flames anyway. But there has to be targeting. You can't just do this laissez-faire, highest bidder system. It's not going to work. You're not going to have workers that can afford to live here.
Exactly. And when you don't have workers who can afford to live here, think about what you're going to lose. You lose your fast food places. They're gone. You don't have anybody to keep them going. They're gone. I mean, come on, use your brain, right? What do we lose if we don't have housing for all of the people who can't afford a $500,000 home?
And, you know, there's a really great study out there that I think was put out by either Realtor.com or Zillow. I want to say it was Zillow. And it's really directly talking about the impacts on housing prices when you introduce affordable housing projects into a community. And every single housing, I mean, they're only looking at housing prices. They track housing prices up at one side and down the other for, you know, they've been doing it for what, 20, well, maybe not 20 years, but at least 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And these studies that come from just this basic data that they're collecting shows that not only do housing prices not drop, they continue to increase the same way they would without that affordable housing. And so there really is a lot of argument against the fact that, so, you know, we talk about like, if we don't get housing, we're going to lose this, we're going to lose that. But also look at places that did the housing, that put in affordable housing, and look at the property value around, because we're talking about taking you know, since a lot of crime on the streets happens as a reflection of not having housing. I mean,
yes.
Could you imagine on your off day, your worst day, not even your worst day, just your half day where you're not feeling good, not having a door to shut, not having a way to shut people out? I mean, I have kids. They continuously ask questions. I'm in my bedroom right now with the door shut. Mm-hmm. So we need that break. We need that sense. We just need that reset. And a lot of crime that we see, Michelle and I see, that, you know, Bernie and Michelle and I, and everybody down at St. Timothy's, a lot of the crime that happens is as a result of lack of housing, as opposed to just people who are just have a criminal mindset. We have those too. We have those everywhere, in housing and without. But we see so much of this crime happening because of the lack of housing. And so adding housing stabilizes people just by default. And there's some, you know, just to say, well, we got the housing and look, we still have people out on the street that are causing crime. Those people are always going to be there. That's there are people that just cannot make it in in housing on their own. And we don't have enough supportive housing. We don't have mental health beds. That's a whole other conversation. And we shouldn't be penalizing other people based off of those who are have mental health disorders.
Real quickly, I just want to a demonstration project that incorporates a low-income housing component, and not to pick on a particular site, but we all know Rio Tinto and the Lone Ranch site. Get, you know, go out to an RFP or RFQ for a major developer, mixed-use developer, and you will find that they are the big ones, and that's a big site, are used to doing these mixed projects with a component, say 20% of the units affordable to, let's say, whatever percentage of AMI you want, you know, whether it's 60, 40, you know, that's just the way it's done in other places.
But, you know, in the meantime, because it is a big property and finding the correct developer for it, and it, you know, in the meantime, I get that the capping the short-term rentals and the, you know, that whole move from a long-term rental and a short-term rental, I get that capping that is not a popular item. But other communities have done it. Other cities on the Oregon coast have done it. Other cities on the Oregon coast are in the process of doing it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Doing it right now.
Right now, exactly.
Because they're seeing a trend. Exactly. They're getting ahead of it. They want to just make sure they got their ducks in a row. And we should too.
Yeah. And if you're an elected official and you want to be a hero, do something like that that benefits the entire whole 100%
of the community.
We would
love you.
And you're going to be a hero.
Exactly. We'll send you a thank you card signed by everybody. 22,000 people.
So I hate to tell you this, guys, but we are once again out of time. I know that green sign did not appear, but
it looks different.
No, it looks different, right? So Tom's telling us that we got 30 seconds. So
you better hurry it up.
Thank you both for showing up again. It's been a great conversation. We'll keep on doing it. And thank you for listening. The impact of the affordable housing crisis on this town is real. If there's no affordable housing here for our workforce that works in the grocery stores, the gas stations, the restaurants, the tourist shops, that workforce will disappear. And that's not even talking about all of the seniors who are on a limited income, who the only way they're going to disappear is they're going to die. So let's just, can we just take a look and take care of each other? We are a community. We have to act like a community. A community takes care of all of its members. Community matters. This is Candace Michelle for Our Community. See you next week.